you know, victory is going to be delicious.
Victory is sweet.
It is.
and kind of milky.
Mm-hmm. And very, yes. So, yes. Anything else you want to share before I start? Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. So this week, we revisit the issue of going back to the office. This time, however, we talked with an old friend of the podcast, Stephen Embry. And Steve takes the approach that we really shouldn't be all that anxious about rushing people back into a physical workspace. Listeners may recall a couple of weeks ago when Richard Hsu joined us, and he stressed that getting as many people back into the office once it's safe is going to be critical. So Steve's going to give us a few counterarguments to Richard's perspectives.
Because we love a good counterargument.
That's when it gets interesting.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's jump into this week's information inspirations. All right, Marlene, I know I told you that we were only going to do one inspiration each this week, but I lied. So I actually brought two.
Of course you did.
but one of them's really super short, so I'll just jump in. And I saw it today. So it's relevant because Halloween's coming up this weekend.
That's right. And
we're a legal podcast, so combine both of those. Ohio State University's Law Library blog has some what they call hauntingly good law review articles. And they point out some articles that anyone who wants to find out how the law and All Hallows Eve coincide, they should check these out. I actually went to one of the articles and read where there's a Mississippi county that they really don't like people dressing up as clowns. And so I think apparently the sheriff has a clown phobia. And so if you're in this county, dress up as anything but a clown.
Well, I'm down with that. Again, you know what a big fan not I am of it. And it's like, yeah, no clowns.
Yeah, you're a huge fan of clowns. I know.
Huge fan. So I confess that since you had two inspirations, I also have two. And the first is actually, I got this from our interviewee today, Stephen Embry. It's about litigation practice during COVID, which, Greg, you know, has gotten my attention since I've been hearing a lot of war stories about it from practitioners. And what struck me about this article is that the author's focus is really all about the author. it's about how it would be easier for him if we went back to the good old days of attorneys bantering in the hall and in-person sidebars. There's no discussion about how it's impacting other participants or that maybe it's less expensive for clients and courts to conduct. And also that it's much more convenient for all of the parties. You know, I've heard very mixed reactions regarding the coaching of witnesses online. Yep. You know, some say it's not really a problem at all. And others say that the courts and attorneys have agreed upon protocols ahead of time to prevent it from becoming an issue. You know, what I say is let's just accept that we aren't going back to the old ways soon, if at all, and embrace the positive aspects of the transformation at hand.
Yeah. All right. Well, Marlene, my unauthorized second inspiration is from north of the border, where Dalhousie, and I hope I said that right, University Law School has a great program to help startups with some of their basic legal needs. And they call it the Initio Technology and Innovation Law Clinic. And it's run by Jacqueline Walsh, who's the director of the law clinic there. The clinic is available in the beautiful Nova Scotia province only.
That's a bummer.
But at some point, they're hoping that they can expand at least across the Canadian Atlantic seaboard. Now, this is a subscription-based service that they're setting up for about $100 a month, and that's Canadian dollars. And And one of the reasons they're doing a subscription-based service for legal services is because that's something that these startups are familiar with, is doing this. And the idea is to help startups with, again, some of their basic legal needs, like contracts and incorporations. Walsh says that they're not trying to compete directly with law firms, and in fact, they're not apparently not even taking money from law firms on this project. But the work that they're doing is much more low level and helping the small or the very new startups only. And if the startups has raised money, then they're sent to a more traditional law firm to seek help. I love this idea, and I think at some point we need to get Jacqueline Walsh on the show and see how this thing is going.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea because I know that there, you know, we've actually since you found this, we've talked to some others who have similar types of models. Yeah. So I think that would be a good episode. All right, so Greg, before I get into my second inspiration, I wanted to share with you and with our listeners that I had a bet with my eldest child that if we hit a certain benchmark on the podcast, that he would bake us a cake, and we're getting a cake.
All right. Getting cake.
We're getting a cake. After all this time, we are getting a cake, and we're getting Tres Leches cake.
Ooh,
so,
yum.
Yeah, it's going to be delicious. All right. My second inspiration is concerning the Supreme Court. So as you know, Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed to the Supreme Court of the United States this week. Mm-hmm. And there is considerable stir over the new 6-3 conservative majority on the court and what impact that will have on jurisprudence. Well, it turns out that it could be a lot or not that much. So I listened to an episode of the new podcast, Innovation Hub, about whether the Supreme Court can be reinvented. Turns out it can under some circumstances. The court numbers could be increased and could even be made to an even number. The president could look beyond the Federal Court of Appeals for appointees to get a larger and maybe more representative pool of the country's views. And Europe also offers another model to consider. A supermajority of the legislature there is required to confirm. So the entire legislative body has to get behind an appointee. And the judges there, either they're required to, or, you know, they just take it upon themselves to come to a single consensus decision, which is representative of all views. So if you have a more balanced appointment process and a more balanced court, decision-making will also likely be more balanced. It's a really good podcast, and I encourage anyone with an interest in the Supreme Court to listen.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to get out of this current political environment for any of those ideas to float, but we'll see.
Did you notice my very subtle, oh, very subtle
under the right circumstances part?
Under the right circumstances.
Yes.
Get out the vote. yes.
Definitely get out and vote.
Yes. And Greg, that wraps up this week's Information Inspirations.
Eventually, we'll come out of this pandemic.
Eventually.
And for many of us, we may think that that's the time where we get back to our regular routine of going back into work, being around our fellow workers. Yeah. And while that may be comforting to some, it's probably not going to be anything like that once we get back to work. And it's not going to look anything like what it was in March.
It's no magical thinking here on this podcast.
It is not. Today's guest gives us his perspective on what he thinks the workplace is going to look like once we do have the option of going back to a physical office. We'd like to welcome Stephen Embry, lawyer and writer with the Tech Law Crossroads blog, back to the show.
Stephen, it's great to have you back.
Thanks.
It's been a while.
It's good to be here. Yeah, I think it was, Greg reminded me before we started, I think it was April a year ago that on the show. It was right after we were in San Francisco. And
that was like 20 years ago now.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
It was back when life was fun. You guys know Adriana Linares, and I was listening to something she was doing the other day, and she phrased it pretty well. She said, yeah, the virus, it took away everything that was fun. Just left us with the bad stuff, but all the fun it took away.
Well, since the last time you've been on the podcast, we understand you've become vice chair of the ABA Law Practice Division.
Right.
And you're in line to chair that division in a couple of years. So tell us about that experience and how it happened.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I've been part of that organization for, oh, maybe 10 years, something like that. I was introduced at that tech show, which the law practice division has every year. This year is going to be virtual, or next year it's going to be virtual. And so I got involved in leadership. I got involved in some strategic planning for the division. And last year I was secretary. This year I am vice chair. Next year, if things progress as they normally do, I will be chair elect. And then the following year I will be chair. Yeah, that's assuming, of course, I behave myself. And, you know,
I was going to say, that's a big commitment.
That's a big assumption. Because we know you a little.
But just a short plug, if you don't mind, for the division. We now have over 20,000 members. We put out a huge amount of content, from webinars to podcasts. We have a master's law practice management series that's going on now. Two magazines, one of which is an e-magazine, the Legal Technology Resource Center, which does the ABA survey, tech survey every year, is under the division. We have book publishing. We have a law technology blog. And, of course, we run tech show every year. It's a challenge, but a lot of smart people, a lot of people working hard, and I'm honored to be part of it, even though we now do a lot more things virtually than we ever did before, but we're used to it. So it's fun.
So, Steve, a couple of weeks ago, we had Richard Hsu on the podcast where he talked about some of the issues that he saw with returning to work after such a long time of working from home. And you and I talked right after that episode, and you had a couple of different views on that situation. So would you mind giving us your overview on what you think is going to happen once we start heading back to the office?
Sure. And, you know, Richard's a smart guy. I know Richard. I respect him. I think a lot of him. And I think, you know, the difference of opinion that we have may be one of degree, and sort of as opposed to, you know, he's a conservative and I'm a liberal kind of thing. therefore, nothing I say is right and nothing he says is right. But a couple of things. One, I think a lot of lawyers overvalue this notion of FaceTime and office time, particularly when it's compared to the alternative. Yeah, I mean, it's good to chit chat around the office, but yeah, I mean, you have to evaluate the good and the bad of both sides of it. And I think there's a lot of good that comes out of doing things virtually. Without evaluating those trade-offs, it's very easy to say, well, the virtual world stinks. I wrote an article about virtual trials, right? Virtual jury trials at the beginning of the pandemic. You know, there was this hue and cry, that sucks. That'll never happen. Well, so now, you know, 6 months later, we've got courts that haven't had any trials for 6 months. Yeah. They're horrendously backed up. And you've got businesses and criminal defendants and all these people who want to have their day in court. They need an answer. You know, it's like I frequently say, most businesses, particularly in America, they can deal with hardship and loss, provided they know what it is, provided it's clear. I mean, if you're going to lose a case for $1 million, I don't want to do that if I'm a business. But if I know it's going to happen, I can plan for it and deal with it. Being in limbo is not a good place. So there's a lot of defendants out there or plaintiffs out there who'd say, jury, maybe it won't be as good, Mr. Lawyer, but it'll get me an answer, and it'll get me an answer quick. So that's the kind of trade-offs that we have to kind of make. The other thing is that I think is important is sort of this notion that once this ends, we'll all go back to normal. And again, this is based on this sort of old world view that the normal that we had before was better.
Right.
Again, it's a trade-off. We have to look at which is better, which is worse. And the longer we go without going back to normal, the more, you know, this inline, online world is going to become the normal. I remember one of the things Richard said was, well, you could have this hybrid situation where some lawyers would be in the office and some members of the team would be online and virtually, and those guys that are online are going to be sort of disadvantaged by that. Well, there's a fundamental assumption in that, right? The fundamental assumption is that the most important person in the room is going to be physically present. That may not be true. Most important person in the room may be the person that's online as we get further down the thing. So we can't just sort of have this assumption that let's all go back to normal, it'll just be a matter of time, and that was so much better. I think we have to say, no, I mean, let's run with the good. Let's adopt the good. Let's embrace the good, and let's quit stewing so much about I can't get together for trial. I can't do an in-person deposition. You know, particularly when it comes to the trial settings, think about the jurors. You know, think about the witnesses. How disruptive it is to these people to be on a jury. And I've been called for jury duty 4 or 5 times. It's horrendous, right? You waste days, right? And you sit there and think, what is wrong with our system? My business doesn't run like this. You know, it's those kind of concepts I think we have to understand and embrace, that online is here to stay and it's going to continue, and let's make it the best world we can and celebrate it.
So tell us a bit about your background and experiences with remote working and the virtual world.
Okay. Well, I was fortunate enough in the 90s. I was a partner at the time in a firm that the eat what you kill kind of compensation formula. So I had a good book of business, and I always remember I was traveling to Florida with my family, my wife and 2 young kids, and I was working on a brief, and I had papers every place and I was scattered and trying to get this brief done. And I took a break and I read this article about Fred Bartlett of Bartlett and Beck, who was big into technology. And he was saying, yeah, I'm working on a brief. His firm was in Chicago. And he said, I'm working on a brief from my condo out in Aspen, looking out at the mountains. And I'm looking at all this paper going, wait a minute, there's got to be a better way than this. And that got me involved. And I've been a mass tort lawyer for 30 plus years. And you can imagine being a mass tort lawyer in Louisville, Kentucky means most of your clients are out of town. Most of your work is out of town. So I became very accustomed to working with people remotely, and formed teams with lawyers that were not in the same office I was in. And so I got very used to doing that. Not to say that we didn't ever meet, but we did a lot of things by telephone. And the funny part about that was it enabled me to get the really the best people for the job, irrespective of place. Then at one point, I was national counsel in a series of construction cases, and we switched from hourly billing to an alternative flat fee billing. And that opened my eyes to a lot of other possibilities about what to do remotely, what to do online, what we didn't need to travel and do in person. So yeah, I was able to work from home back in the 90s.
I was gonna say, what year was it that you started doing the alternative fees?
That was 98, 99, right, something like that.
Trendsetter.
You were well ahead of the curve then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was ahead of the curve, and it was quite cutting edge at the time. It was with an insurance company, believe it or not, which are usually not known for it. And so, yeah, I was able to work from home, and a lot of days I'd meet my kids at the bus stop. And the other thing I learned from that, which may now appear obvious, is I didn't have to work 8 to 5, 8 to 6, Monday through Friday. I could work when I needed to work. That might be a weekend. That might be a night. It gave me flexibility to do things with my family that I didn't have before. I didn't have to commute. And it was fortunate because a lot of my partners were probably wondering, is this dude really working? What's he doing? But because I had so much business and plugging away so many hours, there wasn't much anybody could say at the time. So it was a great experience, and it made me see a lot of advantages to remote work. And since I left the firm and been, of course, publishing the blog, I work at home. And so the pandemics and stay at home orders really didn't affect me that much, other than I do still miss going to Starbucks and, you know, working from Starbucks, but kind of edging my way back there, at least in the nice weather.
It's that pumpkin spice. I know. Yeah. I know.
Yeah. Yeah. Something, this is kind of a ritual, you know, and it's that when you mess with that, then it becomes hard.
So the concept of remote work is nothing really new to you.
No, I mean, remote work, I think, it's been interesting because I see people have taken to it. A lot of people say much quicker than anybody thought, but on the other hand, as I recall, when I made the transition, even back in the 90s when technology wasn't what it is today, it didn't seem to be that much of a transition, really. You know, it required some flexibility and some nimbleness, and it required thinking of things in a different way. And of course, I was aided by that by when we went to the alternative fee. And so I began to look at things a lot differently than I had before. And I think there's some real advantages to the online world. And I think people are starting to see it and recognize it. It's going to be interesting to see where it takes us.
But what about training? Isn't that better done by observing someone, you know, in a face-to-face situation and being able to exchange that way, as Richard Hsu suggests?
Yeah, you know, Richard made some interesting comments on that, and I disagree with him probably in terms of the extent. First of all, you have to back up and sort of say, well, we have this apprenticeship notion for lawyers, right? You are going to apprentice at the heels of the partner, and therefore you will gain this wisdom from on high, and that will make you a better lawyer. And so, you know, even though we all agree that law schools don't train you to be a lawyer, most law firms are like, yeah, that's how we're going to do it. And we have no training program. Why do we need a training program? That just takes away from billable hours, right? But what happens when you do that is you have no systematic training where you say, okay, these are the attributes of a good and successful lawyer, and this is what we're going to train for. And then you leave it completely to happenstance, right? I mean, I was fortunate enough to have, well, maybe fortunate enough, I was fortunate enough to have a very good mentor when I was coming up in the mass tort field. And, you know, I developed into a reasonably successful lawyer. I might add that I also picked up some really bad habits from this particular lawyer. So, but the problem is that we have, in sort of latching on to this system, this apprenticeship notion that we have to sit at the heels of the partner, we've abandoned any sort of formal training program that would lead to everybody getting good training, not just happenstance training to be with a good mentor or a bad mentor, but everybody gets a core basic training.
That's a lot of work, though, right? I mean, that's a lot of thought and design.
Look at the alternative, right? I mean, the problem that lawyers have had with it is, oh my God, we can't abandon that many billable hours. So a couple of things ended up happening, right? Clients begin saying, we're not paying for that stuff. Forget it. You're not taking an associate to a deposition to watch you do it. Forget it. Not going to happen anymore. And so, you know, now we have all this talent that a law firm has invested in, which we pay a lot of money for, who are not getting trained. And for litigators, it's a particular problem, right? Because there are no trials to speak of, even before the pandemic. The number of trials has gone down considerably. And so you've got all these people that you've invested in, but yet they're not getting trained in a systematic way. It's not necessarily so much that you can do training virtually, although I think you can do some training virtually. It's more the sort of the philosophical idea that we have to be physically present with one another to train, because this is an apprenticeship business. And it then leads to this other concept, which is, you know, that's the only way to really do it, because we're lawyers. Right? I mean, we're special.
We've figured it out.
We have. And I was listening to a speaker at the NEOTA networking thing today, and he went into this spiel about, well, you know, we do really complex things, and you know, it takes a long time to learn how to do these things, and there's a lot of skill involved. It's like, well, so is an airplane pilot, right? So is a brain surgeon, right? And so is, I might add, an insurance adjuster, which is really kind of an interesting idea, right? Because most insurance adjusters are legally trained. They are making monumental decisions with people's lives. They have to know the law. They have to be experienced. And yet most of them, for 10 years, have been working remotely in a paperless environment. right? So that the idea that what they do is somehow not as valuable as what I do because I happen to be in a law firm is really kind of an arrogant sort of, you know, only I can do this. And sorry, guys, you can't. Club's closed. And by the way, the only way you can get into the club is you apprentice for me, yeah. My special small snowflake. Now, what does that lead to, right? Here's the, and this is an Embry hypothesis, okay? Not, I don't have any empirical data, but when most people select a mentee or somebody to work with them, younger person to work with them on the team, they tend to select somebody that looks like them and acts like them. In law firms
that's
today,
comfortable, right?
In law firms that's today, you know, I mean, the ABA surveys that came out a year or so ago, is along with a number of others, are sad evidence of it. Most of those people in those training positions are white males. So, you know, question or query, as they used to say in law school, is this notion that we have to apprentice to somebody, you know, for years and not going to do a formal training, not make sure everybody has a core skill set of training so that we all start from the same base. We may not all end up, but we all start from the same base. Is that diminishing women, people of color who are not being selected to work on with the ace partner? The number one partner guy, you know, the guy, right? He's always a guy, right? The rainmaker, who of course is not skilled at training, right? He's skilled at being a lawyer and more often than not at making money. So now you have this sort of system where you've got happenstance, you know, hit or miss training. You've got the potential for it to injure certain segments of the population that we need to have practicing law, that we need in our law firms, and the quality of the training is sort of hit or miss. It's unknown because we never take the time to sit down and say, here's what a good lawyer, being a good lawyer means, and here's the attributes, the skill sets that we want to make sure they need to have. And I can assure you, one of those skill sets is not sitting in, like when I was an associate, it's not so much anymore, sitting in a dusty warehouse reading reams of paper and thinking to myself, I could have done this when I was a junior in high school. What has it been? Oh, that's what I'm doing this for, to be trained for this. So it's not so much that I objected to what Richard said about, you know, the need to be together for training, as much as the system that we have, the sort of the apprenticeship sort of notion has not worked well. It's terribly, terribly inefficient. Clients don't want to pay for it anymore, which means the law firm has to do one of two things, either not train, or if they're going to have an associate observe, right, they have to pay for it. And we all know how that works out for the most part.
You know, and it's interesting because, you know, if you're saying there's a more formalized training, I bet you a lot of the parts of that could be delivered in a remote environment a lot more easily than, say, this apprentice model.
Well, and here's the thing about that. So let's think about what a typical law firm is today. Now, I come from a bigger law firm, right? So I am Law 200 law firm. So I can't speak to a solo or a small shop. But so today, when I was practicing law, I would come into the office, and as somebody, I think Richard Dingell said this on a podcast not long ago, law firms are quiet places. I mean, they really are quiet places. You come in, you hang your coat up, you get your coffee, you close your door, and you work. And you might come out of that little cubbyhole and use the restroom and get more coffee, but then you go back and you work. So, you know, so that's what happens. Everybody's working. Associates are all working. So now if you want to have a training program, yes, you can have a training program, but let's refocus that a little bit. Let's do what we can online. And then instead of having associates that have kids and have a family come to the office 8 to 7 every day so they can go sit in their cubbyhole, close the door and work and not see anybody, let's have them work from home and do all the stuff they would do in the office with the door closed, sort of on their time frame, and then have them come in for the training that we say is critical to be face-to-face, come in one day, cram it, put it all in one day, have them come in one day, do what they need to do, meet with whatever teams they need to meet with, and go home and then work from home the rest of the time. It saves the commute. It saves their family life. It gives them some ability to do something besides sit in the car or sit in an office all the time. A lot of people say, well, we miss these water cooler conversations, right? That's another sort of, I would say, red herring in all this mix. Well,
there is a thing called chat, you know?
Yeah. When I was in law school and worked for a small firm, maybe we had some of that. But I had to tell you, when I worked at a law firm, I didn't have any of that. I mean, very rarely, if I needed to talk to somebody, if I had a problem, I'd call them up, like I do now, except now I do it by video. But in terms of bumping into somebody at the water cooler and saying, you got a minute, I'd probably get, not right now, I'm busy, right? And in fact, you know, you don't mind a funny story, like a lot of law firms, we would let sort of older partners, retired partners be of counsel, and they could come in and, you know, have a small office and, you know, do whatever they want to do. So we had one lawyer who, he was a very successful lawyer and everybody liked him and, you know, good storyteller. And so when he made this transition, he would come in and as years went by, if you saw him in the hall, he would light up because he wanted to tell you a story, right? And so you would like duck into an empty office or run someplace to get away from him because I got to build time. And, you know, law firms are, that's how, that time is money. That's how they make their money, better or worse, by the hour. And, you know, chit-chat, particularly for younger lawyers, right? And I remember making this calculation in my head. You know, if I go into my office and close the door, shut the door and work really hard, I can get out of here a little early. Every minute I waste talking to, you know, Greg in the hallway, well, that's an hour.
I don't think that's just associates. I think that's kind of everybody, that's in the billable process. They all are kind of thinking like, okay, you know, I work through lunch and, you know, and I sort of, you know, keep things going and I'll get done early enough that, you know, I can go home in a reasonable hour.
Yeah.
Well, what about the client, their side of things? What's going to be the client's expectations going forward?
Well, I think you probably saw in the news, Microsoft is, they're not going back to work for at least for another year. Facebook isn't going back maybe ever. Twitter may never go back to work. I can't tell you how many times, particularly in the later years of my practice, I dealt with general counsel that were not only not in the same town I was in, they weren't even in the same town as their company headquarters.
Right.
They were working from home, right? So their expectations are going to be, you better be able to do things online. You know, if you want to represent me, you know, you better be able to handle things online and you better be able to take a virtual deposition, handle a virtual trial. The rest of the world is doing things online. I'm not willing to pay you to travel 6 hours to California for a 30-minute hearing and then travel 6 hours back. I'm not going to do it, particularly when everybody else is online doing it. And I think we're going to see more and more of that kind of mindset of clients who themselves are very adept at working online. Most businesses run that way. And they sort of look at this, you know, I always like to call special snowflake. They sort of look at this us as this, as these special snowflakes and just sort of giggle like, what? Right.
What world special, do we live in? Right?
Yeah. Go meet with my CFO every day to talk about all the legal expenses that are over budget. Yeah. Then tell me you're a special snowflake, right?
You had mentioned about lawyers sort of going into their cubbyhole and working. And I wanted to parallel that because, you know, historically that's how it's been. How does working remotely kind of impact that model? I would imagine not too much. I mean, because you know, you're sort of trading one cubbyhole for another cubbyhole.
Yeah, and here's the fundamental difference, and it's something that I discovered. Okay, in the office cubbyhole, I'm expected to be there 8:30, 6:30, 7:30, you name the hours, right? And so that means whatever is going on in my real life with my wife, my kids, by health, doctor's appointments, you know, all has to be structured around that chunk of time, right? But when I'm working remotely, I can move that cubbyhole time to the night, to the weekend, to the morning, to a time that lets me have greater flexibility. And in fact, I was fortunate enough to go to the NetDocs virtual conferences, and they made a piece of data, and they said, you know, our data shows that people are working more in the evenings and more on the weekends since the pandemic. Now, your first reaction would be, oh yeah, people are just working harder, and which is, you know, that's what I said. Yeah, everybody's just working harder. And they said, well, we're not sure that people are just working harder. They're working at different times that's more convenient for them. So that's the trade-off. Now, of course, I don't have younger kids anymore. I don't have, you know, worry about, you know, having to homeschool kids and all that kind of jazz. That's a complicating issue and factor, and I don't mean to diminish that at all. But it's also a complicating factor if I had to have small kids that had to learn online and I had to go to the office every day, right? And that's a problem as well. So there's always going to be kind of issues and problems and various ways of looking at things. To me, part of the problem I had with some of Richard's conclusions were, it was sort of an assumption that doing things in person was better. It's always better. And without saying, well, it may be different, but that doesn't mean it's always better, right? And there's a great quote from Joe Flom, the founder of Skadden Arps, way back, you know, whenever he founded it. You know, he was asked one time, well, wasn't the old gentlemanly way of doing practicing law better? I mean, he was a pretty rough around the edges guy, kind of guy. And, you know, and he said, well, was it better when, you know, your father ran the law firm and you succeeded as opposed to who did the best job? What was so good about that? What was so good about only certain people could get into clubs and get clients and other people were excluded? Or that women or Jewish lawyers or African-American lawyers couldn't even get a job at certain firms? What's good about that? You know, what was so great that about your family background being more important than what you could do? And then he got to the end of all this. And then he said, and this is the part I think that's really applicable here. Every change involves some loss. The question is whether you are better off or worse off with what you've lost and what you've gained. And, you know, when you step back and say, okay, what have we gained from this virtual world? I don't see anything. I can't see my friends. I can't travel. I can't, I went to the UltaCon. Sounds like all I do is go to conferences, right? I didn't go to a fair amount of them. But what I've discovered is there are more people going to these conferences now that they're virtual, and they're hearing dynamite speakers. And my guess is that the people that are going that never went before are younger, are more energetic, are more diverse, and they're going to come back, as I always do from any of these conferences, energized, right? They're going to go to their firms and they're going to go to their jobs and they're going to say, we want to make a change. We want to drive some change. I heard Seth Godin talk and I want to do something, right? And that's great, right? That's wonderful because these people, they never got to go. So you have the same faces go to all these conferences and meetings. We all said the same things over and over again. And this other group couldn't go because it cost too much and it was too disruptive and it was all the travel and blah, 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 blah. Then you step back and you say, okay, but there's this training thing. Right? How are younger lawyers going to observe me take a deposition without being there physically? Well, think of it this way. Most depositions today are virtual, right? And so I can't charge my client to let a young lawyer go with me to a deposition. But if a young lawyer doesn't have to travel, if he doesn't have to sit through the entire part of the deposition, the boring crap that anybody could do, and he gets to see just the critical part in how I do it, and not just one, 5, 10, all could plug in and watch. Now you're observing something. The same is true with going to court. You know, the courthouse are now more and more hearings are virtual. There's nothing to prevent us letting our associates observe more things. This is less things because we're now in the virtual world. And so, yeah, it's a trade-off. I'd love to be sitting in the room with you guys, you know, talking. But on the other hand, you know,
what's the likelihood that it would actually happen?
That's,
you know,
right.
And here we have this ability to do this, you know, instantaneously at our leisure,
yeah.
Right?
I mean,
there's definitely trade-offs, but
right,
you know, there's also benefits.
I'm part of a lunch group. You guys know Eric Kaplan. He's formed this virtual lunch group, and you know, we get together. People come in, come out every day for an hour, and I've met 20, 25, 30 people and gotten to know them pretty well because I see them now every day as opposed to once a year, maybe passing them in a hall at a ILTA conference with 5,000 other people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's a plus, right? And so, yeah, there are trade-offs, but there are good things about this world too. And
you know, like the more sustained interaction,
yeah.
But also, you know, being able to see you like in your natural environment,
right.
If you will,
yeah.
You know? All right. So, you know, given, you know, the client experience you've talked about and given how the courts are sort of moving, you know, in a forward moving type of direction, what are some of the practical realities that you think will guide law firms in making decisions about how to reopen?
Cost and cost.
It's always money.
real estate is the second highest cost for law firms, right behind salaries, right? I mean, that's where it is. And it's not just real estate. It is prime real estate, right? Downtown, top.
We're not in the strip malls.
Yeah.
We're not talking about the strip malls.
Not in strip malls. And, you know, if you look at the statistics, most businesses have a 3 to 4 times ratio of employees to offices, right? Lawyers, it's 1 to 1, right? Or maybe 1 to 2. Some lawyers have 2 offices, right? So, I mean, we got this huge amount of space under the assumption that clients watch this. They don't, because that's not what they have.
Well, most of the time, they're not even there.
And they're not even there.
They don't go to the office to visit.
They don't want to drive.
Lawyers go to them.
Yeah. If you're a client in town, they don't want to drive downtown to do all this. So now you've got this huge amount of cost, and you've got law firm management just kind of scratching their head going, oh, this working at home stuff, this is kind of working out. And we could save like some money here if we didn't have the same amount of space. And then you've got another phenomenon, which is landlords are looking ahead, right? They're not stupid. And they're saying, well, I tell you what, law firm, we'll restructure your lease and you won't have to take as much space provided that you extend the term lease, right? So that protects us and gives you a price break. So you're starting to see these deals kind of being cut so that existing leases are being reformulated. And what does all that mean in the end? There may not be a place for us to all go back to, right? The pandemic may end someday and we'll say, okay, we're ready to go back to work. And the managing partner is going to say, well, Marlene, you can come in 3 days. You can come in 2 days a week. And we have this this office over here for you. And the other 2 days, Greg's going to be using that office.
It's a hotel. Make sure you clean up after yourself,
mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. Make sure you clean up your mess, Marlene.
Cushman and Wakefield did a
get rid of all your tchotchkes, Greg.
Cushman and Wakefield, which is a big real estate development company, they did a survey and not long ago when they asked law firms, like, when this is over, how many of you are going to go back just like it was and have the same kind of office configuration? How many firms are going to say? 70% of them said, we're going to change. We're going to make changes to our workspace. We're going to have more collaborative kind of spaces. We're going to have less offices. There's going to be hoteling in these offices. And so, you know, the firms that aren't willing to do that, right, are going to come under a lot of severe price pressure because other firms are doing it and they're going to keep doing it. Now you also have this, the other countervailing, the other pressure on them is with the talent that's out there. People like working at home. Young lawyers like working at home. I like working at home. We all like working at home for the most part. We don't like to get in the car and spend hours commuting and wasting time and not being able to work when we want, all that kind of stuff. So the talent is going to start going toward the firms that are more flexible with their workspaces. And so this is sort of the thing that bothers me about, you know, some people's attitude that this is all, the online world is bad. Let's just twiddle our thumbs and wait. And we'll all go back to work here when the vaccine comes. You know, not if, but when. Like, oh, yeah. Yeah, right. Like, I haven't seen it yet, but, you know, it's, everybody's talking like it's going to be here next week. Well, nobody's got one yet. But the truth of the matter is the world is going to will probably be changed when we go back. Oh, and if you sit back and twiddle your thumbs and think, oh, I don't have to worry about that because it'll be, you know, I don't have to worry about how to do all this online. I don't have to worry about appearing well online because it's all going to be over soon, or how to make a good presentation online. That's wrong. I mean, it's going to change things. You know, I'm not one of those that like a lot of people in the legal tech field that say, oh, well, everything's now changed. The revolution is here. Hooray! You know, the revolution we've all been talking about for the last 25 years that never seems to come. I don't think we're there. You know, Bill Gates one time said we tend to overestimate the immediate effects of technology and underestimate the long-term effects of technology. So I don't think that the remote work and virtual world is going to revolutionize the practice of law today. But I think if we look back from 10 years, like we look back on the iPhone, you know, and when it was introduced, we're gonna say, boy, that really did change things a lot. Wow. I didn't never really thought about it. But looking back now, yeah, it changed a lot of things. So yeah, Marlene, you're right. I mean, I think you can do a lot of things online. I think we need to be prepared for that new world and embrace it and run with it.
And you mentioned that it's we're looking at this not as an if, but a when we have a vaccine and when we get back into the office in some aspect. So pull out your crystal ball here and tell us what are your predictions about what will happen when we go back to whatever the normal is.
Well, you know, first of all, you know, lawyers are the slowest to go back so far. And there's a lot of reasons for that, not the least of which is they have the most premier real estate on the top floors of buildings and cities, which all sounds well and good. But, you know, you got to get on an elevator to get to that floor. Like, right? And there's, you know, 65 other floors of people that may be trying to get on the elevator and only two can go at a time. You think a commute for an hour and a half in a car was bad. Then you got another hour and a half waiting on the elevator. So they're slow going back, and lawyers are resistant to change. So I think what we're going to see is that because of the cost factor, and because of the need to reduce cost and reduce space, that's going to push firms to be less rigid in forcing people to go back. You're going to see the talented people are going to flock to firms where they have more flexibility, I believe. And you're going to see the clients and the judges adopting more and more online world. So yes, I mean, someday we'll start going back. There'll be more online stuff. That doesn't necessarily mean, you know, as I said a while ago, it doesn't necessarily mean that the revolution in legal and law is going to happen all at once. It won't. Yeah. But as we begin to make these strides in the virtual world, begin doing things more remotely, we begin seeing how easy it is to adopt a lot of this technology. You know, and it's fortunate, by the way, that the pandemic came at the stage of technology when it did. But otherwise, it would have been probably harder. Although, you know, looking back on it, it wasn't that hard when I did it. We didn't have Zoom, but we have a lot more intuitive kind of technology now than we ever did. And that's just going to keep getting better. You know, we haven't solved the virtual happy hour yet, which, frankly, between you and I think are kind of dreadful, right? Because, you know.
Yeah, I've noticed a significant drop off in attendance in the happy hours. Yeah.
We haven't solved that yet, but we will. I mean, we'll come up with a way to make that better. Just like Eric Kaplan has made this virtual lunch something that I look forward to going to every day, right? We may not have virtual happy hours. We may have, you know, virtual lunches with a group of people, but we'll get there. We'll get to that kind of thing. But we have to, as I told somebody the other day, all these conferences are, you know, they're really like, what are we going to do with the exhibitors and sponsors? They don't like this new world. They don't get people coming and going to booths and all that kind of jazz. And well, that's part of the problem is we're trying to take an in-person conference and cram it into online, right? what we need to do is to rethink the whole kind of experience of what it means to be a sponsor or exhibitor or have that kind of role and how that fits into the online world. And it, we don't get there by saying, you know, I really think it was better before and I just want to wait, ride it out, bide my time, keep my powder dry, and it'll all get back to normal soon. No, we get there by thinking, how can we reimagine this to make it something that we all want to be a part of? So yeah, I think changes will come. I think there'll be, even when we get closer back to normal, I still think there will be a lot of people that will work from home because they want to, and because it's cheaper, it's more convenient, it's as productive, and you can do just about as many things, particularly now, online than you could before. I mean, you can try a case online.
Right.
You can do a client pitch online. You can have team meetings online with your team. Now, yes, there's always going to be the situation where, because it's so intense, because it's so personal, that we have to have an in-person conversation. There's always going to be that deposition that is so critical that I have to take it in person if I get a judge to let me do it, right? Which is another issue. But there's always going to be a place for that, but it's going to get smaller and smaller, and we have to recognize that.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you so much for joining us.
I'll say it's been a great fun being on the show again. It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You bet.
Okay. Take care now. So long.
Well, it's always great to catch up with Steve Embry, and it was really nice of him, I think, to reach out to us and give us kind of a counter, although a very polite and very cordial counter to what we had with Richard Hsu a couple of weeks ago.
Well, you know, polite and cordial is a refreshing change from what we've been used to
for the last several years.
Exactly right. So I also want to say thank you to Stephen for reaching out. This was a really good conversation. And, you know, it's really good to get opposing views on each thing, just to, you know, to see where everybody stands.
Yeah. I will be happy just once we can kind of figure out what this new regular work is going to look like once we go back.
I think a lot of people are looking forward to that because, you know, right now everything is very fluid, and I know that that's, you know, really troubling to some people. And, you know, I guess my thought on this is look, you know, you deal with what you can control. And, you know, if you can't, then you just can't, you just have to sort of let that go. And for right now, we're all trying to figure out the right way and what's going to make sense. And, you know, making these types of decisions is kind of a messy process. And we just have to be flexible and roll with it.
Yeah. All right. Well, everyone, until we can get back, everyone stay safe. And
yes,
hopefully
please.
That'll help us get back a little quicker. So thanks again to Stephen Embry for joining us on the pod today.
Before we go, we want to remind listeners to take the time to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Rate and review us as well. If you have comments about today's show or suggestions for a future show, you can reach us on Twitter at @GabeBauerM or at @Glambert, or you can call the Geek & Review hotline at 713-487-7270 or email us at geekandreviewpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene. Get out and vote.
Done and done. I am going to supervise the making of cake. Hey!